So today's Friday, April 14th, 2019. I'm Leslie McCartney here with Letty Hughes and Katie Cullen in the National, or sorry, in the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve offices for the National Park Service in Nome, Alaska. And we're here talking about the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve and Klondike Gold Rush National Historic Park project, where we're looking at environmental and climate changes in both parks. So thank you very much, Letty, for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to us today. I'll let you both introduce yourselves. Katie or Letty?
Hi, I'm Katie Cullen. I am the Interpretation and Education Program Manager at Bering Land Bridge National Preserve, headquartered in Nome, Alaska.
Letty?
Hi, I'm Letty Hughes. I'm the wildlife biologist for Bering Land Bridge National Preserve. I'm also based here in Nome.
Great. Well, thank you. So, Letty, before we start, we just kind of like to do a little bit of biographical information, perhaps where you're from, a bit of your education, how you became a wildlife biologist.
Okay. Which one do I start with?
Whichever one, where you come originally.
Okay. Well, guess I'll start from the very beginning. So I was born in Montana, and then my family moved to Alaska in the interior, and when I was probably 5 or 6. And so from there, so basically Alaska's been my home for, since then. So how did I?
Where did you go to school then?
Oh, I went to school in the interior.
In Fairbanks?
So that's where I did my schooling. And then for, college, it was UAF. I also went to spend a little bit of time in Missoula attending school there. And then but I, ended up coming back when I was getting doing summer work out as a fish and wildlife technician. So that's kind of then why I decided to continue to stay up in Alaska. So I guess how I decided I wanted to get into the wildlife field was, well, like most of us in my career field, it's because of like animals or our love of outdoors and the environment, whether it's coming from, like being the concerning or just growing up hunting and fishing or, some sort of lifestyle. So that's, and I've just always had just been around animals my entire life. So I was like, well, I could be a veterinarian, I could be a wildlife biologist, and so I just went for the wildlife biologist field. So,
Excellent. Who are some of your wildlife biologist teachers at UAF?
oh boy,
Do
that's
you remember?
yeah. So some of them were. I can seem in my head. Obviously very influential at, Well, I'll have to think on them because I have
That's
them, but
okay.
my name's not,
If
the
they
names
come
aren't
to you, you
coming.
can. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what year did you graduate then?
2004, maybe? I think 2004.
So, you've been in the field a good long time.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first job then when you graduated?
So I had taken on an intern position with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So it was through the Arctic Marine Mammal Program up in Fairbanks. And so I had started out, besides doing the summer technician work, then I had taken on this intern position. And it dealt with, I mean, sieving and going through seal stomach contents and like, or whales and stuff. And I was like, well, for that little bit of money, I can do that. And so as, stinky stuff as it was. So then when I graduated, from UAF, I was able to then move into more of a technician role with the Marine Mammal Program. But then I decided to just kind of explore a little bit more, and I took a job as a wildlife biologist with the state in Bethel, Alaska. And so I was up there for about a year and a half, And then there was a position opening up in Nome. And so I put in for that and I got the job. And then so in 2008, I moved out here and I've been out here since 2008.
Wow. So you were originally working for Fish and Wildlife here in Nome.
No, Fish and Game.
Fish and Game, sorry. Fish and Game here. And how long have you been with the National Park Service then?
Very short time. I came on in mid-July of 2018.
Okay. So we were talking just before we started to do the interview that your experience is more on the Seward Peninsula and Alaska as a whole, correct?
More, I would say definitely more on the Seward Peninsula as a whole, you know, in terms of like what my work required me to do, you know, helped deal with all of, you know, Game Management Unit 22. So sometimes the survey work would take, you know, place in Uniclete up in the New Lotto Hills. Other times it would take place right outside Nome right here. Other times it would be flying over in the preserve. So so you got to see like this whole slew of, you know, how the Seward Peninsula kind of has, you know, changed or like weather-wise or maybe lack of snow or a lot of snow.
So, go ahead.
I was going to ask, so I consider you an expert on muskox. But I know you've also worked on other large mammals, I believe. With Fish and Game, what different kind of species did you work with?
Yeah, so because I spent many decade plus years in more of population manager, you know, position. So it wasn't like it was just, I didn't work on just, you know, maybe birds or one species of like a moose. That just, you know, wasn't more of the research aspect. So it'd be, you know, caribou, bears, moose, muskox, some wolf surveys, you know. Yeah.
And are these surveys to look at, like, population numbers and the health of the population?
Try or trends, you know, in terms of, trying to get a little bit better idea on, you know, where they're at and so forth. And with, you know, the moose, yeah, definitely moose surveys, muskox surveys, habitat work, you know. So it all, you know, goes back to being, you know, for a management purpose and whether for the population, also for hunting and subsistence. So that's...
And are these surveys run regularly at certain number of years or...
Yeah, so, you know, depending, many times the programs will have, like, is out here, it's broken into game management subunits, so you'll have A, B, C, D, and E. Well, you can't do all that in 1 year, so it's like a rotating schedule. So, like, in 2020, the plan is to do Unit 22 D and E, and so that's a huge collaborative effort between Fish and Game and National Park Service to get that work done.
And what will you be looking at in that survey?
It'll be a moose survey.
Moose survey, mm-hmm. Again. So how many years of data, then, must you have for these various surveys?
It goes way back. It does. You know, and even with some of the the methodology that has changed, I mean, it's still, there's enough. You can have a pretty good grasp. Oh, in some cases, some places might get done every, you know, 3 years, 5 years, but it's still, you still have this nice idea of what's going on.
So what trends have you seen then over these years with this longitudinal data?
On, talking about for like moose?
For moose?
Well, yeah, so in some areas, for example, like 22D, that moose population has experienced a decline. And so, you know, when I was over with Fish and Game, we did some habitat browse work to just, you know, I explain it to people as to, are moose eating themselves out of house and home? You know, mm-hmm. Is it, or is there something else going on? You know, like, could it be predators if it's mm-hmm. not the habitat? Or, and so that's what we were looking at as well. But in addition, and so really, it's, you know, the state has really been diving into as to why that moose population has, like, been declining. And so that's something that's, you know, I would say fairly recent.
And it's been consistently declining for a number of years?
Yeah. Okay. So, and then like for the muskox population, you know, it had reached, you know, its highest peak of, you know, close to 3,500. And then it just, it had also experienced a decline as well. But, and so now that population's, you know, stable, but yet, you know, once again, this is a huge cooperation project between, you know, the state, Fish and Game, BLM, Fish and Wildlife Service. And because of the weather this year, we actually had to cancel the survey.
And the weather is because it got mild so quickly?
No.
But why was the weather? Oh,
well, so, you know, when you have a survey such as that, a lot of times you're having 5 to 9 cubs in the air. I mean, it takes a lot of airplane support, mm-hmm. you know, and I mean, it's, yeah, you're flying all the way from like the Yukon area all the way up into like near Buckland and up into Espenberg area. Wow. It's a lot of flying. And so you need to have really good weather. And out here, just with winds and visibility and stuff, you just don't always get that weather. I've seen it once where we finished that survey in 5 days because we had like mm-hmm. 9 cubs in the air, and it was just wonderful, this window. And But normally it takes really a long time to do because of all this other variables. So between all the storms we were having, what, we had like 16, 18 storms like in a row this year?
8,700, yeah.
It was just ridiculous how many was going on. But as a result of that, everyone's field work just kind of came to a complete halt. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes a question of priority. Like, you know, now that the weather is getting good, what can we get done, you know, in a reasonable time before snow starts melting and you can't see brown on brown? And so those, you know, are all decisions that had to be made. And, you know, and that was in, those decisions are being made, you know, with the state too, you know, they're, but yeah, so they were like, well, we got these moose surveys going on. We have this going on. So it was decided that the survey would not happen.
Yeah. Are there, like, just thinking of when you were saying, you know, you have to kind of prioritize as a result of the weather and different factors, are there for state and or federal together certain species that would be like the top 5 priorities, like for, or I wonder, it got me thinking like, I don't know if it would even be identified that way, you know, but like, if it could be.
Yeah, well, you know, it definitely, yeah, not to have made it sound like muskox are not a priority, it's just for the amount of time that was going to require, mm-hmm. you know, so definitely muskox are, you know, important subsistence resource out here. But maybe, you know, moose more so, you know, in terms of like what people really want. And mm-hmm. so, but it's also a matter of like being able to retain your pilots, because a lot of, you know, there's, you only have so many survey pilots and everyone wants those survey pilots. So, you know, they, that's their livelihood. So they, so there's this window of, you know, of like when you can use them before they go on to the next project. So there was that too. Mm-hmm. Just a matter of like being able to retain people to do a project. So, you know, and you look at it as like, well, this population has been stable, you know, so mm-hmm. we give, you know, in terms of SNMS, because a harvest population manager, we're harvesting less than 2% of the muskox population on the Seward Peninsula. So we will do the survey in 2021. Mm-hmm. So it's all these, you know, like, okay, what's this population doing? What's, you know, what mm-hmm. can we do? What can we, information can we still get, you know? We're still doing the composition work next week, so we can still get bull cow ratios and stuff. So it's not like we just completely just put muskox over to the side. We just couldn't get the estimate of the number of animals on the landscape.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I guess I was like, oh, I wonder if, like, yeah, there's, like, these are our, you know, like, Bering Lambridge and the Arctic Inventory and Monitoring Network has the vital signs.
Yeah.
Like, is there, a kind of like a state federal collaborative like set of these are our big concern like or big questions for like different species. And
so yeah, so that's a good question. So I'm learning as this, I've also taken on the role of the muskox vital sign for the network. So, and there was a protocol recently published, I want to say in November, where, you know, it was working with the state and it dealt definitely more with the Seward Peninsula as to, you know, here's what we look at, you know, here's kind of a timeline, you know, it doesn't, but you can all, it's kind of a living document as well, but it at least provides a guideline that's been set by the state and also the network. So,
interesting.
I think, you know, I can't speak for other areas in the state, but I can say for, like, out in, you know, Unit 23, Kotzebue area, and out here, I think, you know, Park Service has a pretty good, you know, relationship with working with the state and having those agreements and as to what's, like, a priority and what needs to get done. Right. So.
That's really neat. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So coming back to your question, are the moose eating themselves out of house and home? How, what preliminary conclusions have you come to, or is it too early for that?
It's so, it had appeared that that was not the case. However, the moose researcher over at the state had also collected vegetation to be able to look at the quality. So maybe it's poor quality, not than just the amount that they're eating, and so that's still ongoing. So I don't know where he's at with that.
Interesting.
But, yeah.
Which brings us to changing vegetation. In all the years that you've been looking at the Seward Peninsula, have you seen changes in vegetation for fodder for the animals?
You know, one of the things that, you know, like a lot of the folks that I've been flying with or other biologists who have been out here for a really long time, one of the things that I hear them comment on too is like just how much more like wild alders or are coming in to, you know, play, you know, or just like or willows or there's or we don't have a lot of fires out here, so then you don't have a lot of new growth being regenerated with willows. So there's always that discussion, you know, as to like, man, I've just seen this area become just more shrubby along here. Or what I've heard from folks around with serpentine is just becoming like more alders and willows around the serpentine area than what used to be there. So, and I don't know if that's just the result of maybe beavers being in there or maybe just over time. So, but that's one of the things that I've heard folks say is definitely more getting more shrubby vegetation around the serpentine area than what they remember. Mm-hmm. And even what the photos have depicted.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Since you're a wildlife biologist, the freezing and the rain and freezing on top of, for the lichen, for caribou, I'm not too sure about muskox, I'm not very schooled in that. How is that affecting populations?
So there's a retired fish and game biologist who spent many years out here, is actually out here helping with the reindeer herders and then spent 20 plus years out in Kotzebue, Jim Dow. And that was, and it's definitely, I mean, it's a concern when you have these, you know, rain thawing events and then freezing, it causes issues for, you know, for even muskox and caribou to crater, you know, and all that stuff is just, you know, freezing solid. So, so there's definitely concern there in terms of, you know, because it can bring on a harsh winter and you could have, you know, mortality related to that.
Yeah. Ooh, for our younger audiences listening to the interview, what is, how would you describe cratering?
Yeah, so a lot of times they can use their feet or they'll use like, you know, their the shovels on their antlers. So they just dig in the snow, you know, and that's, I mean, what it looks like. It's like this bowl, this, you know, just a bowl, and you can
kind of like scooping out.
And you can see that, you know, muskox will do that, when they are wintering up in like the higher elevations where it's a little bit more windblown, snow free. So, cause they have horns, not antlers, but they have to be able to dig, you know, a little bit. And so you'll see that too. So definitely really, yeah, it makes a big difference, especially later in the year when those animals are just running on whatever remaining fat reserves they have, you know. And so, you know, if you go into winter in poor shape, you know, and then you start having freezing rain and these thawing events, then it can be really bad for you.
Yeah. And over the years, have you seen a trend that's happening more and more often?
You know, that's, that would be a question for, well, Jim Dow and Alex Hansen's in there now at the state. Because they really have, you know, spent time looking at that. You know, as a biologist, we always wonder about it when, you know, we get these, like, rains later in the year and then it just freezes again and you're like, oh, I wonder if that's going to have anything to do with, you know, like, calving. I mean, there's all these questions you always have to wonder about, or even at, let's say, at this time of year too, when animals, muskoxen start calving later in April, but then you can still get these, you know, really bad snow and cool, freezing events. Right. So, yeah.
Since you've been in this, working in the Seward Peninsula for many years, have you noticed lots of environmental or climate changes? And if so, what are they?
Well, definitely, I think I can say environmental changes. You know, one of the things that, so moose surveys have generally happened out here on the Seward Peninsula starting about mid-February, and the reason for that was because by that time, the storms have passed, you know, everything's been done, your daylight's getting longer, and you can complete these surveys, you know, within a reasonably good, you know, 2-week window. But lately, the last, you know, couple of years, we've had these, you know, storms that have been occurring well into March. And or you have years where, so like the last year we had really high snow year, this year it's looking like we're going to have, you know, close to that as well. But then you also have the thing of like, there's just not enough snow. So there's another environmental, you know, as well. You're like, well, you know, we can't do the survey this year because you're literally trying to find brown muskox on brown vegetation. Mm-hmm. And so, or you consider doing a moose survey that you're like, wow, you know, here's the moose. And that's something that, you know, I've heard even from the YK area and other areas. It's just like, well, there's just not enough snow to do this type of method now. So what do we do? So I think those are big environmental changes that I've seen and or have heard from other biologists around the state, in the sense of, you know, there's just not enough snow to do this. And in like our case, the last couple of years on the Seward Peninsula, it's been, we've had these storms go way into, late into the spring. Yeah. So.
And then by the time the storms are over, you just can't.
It becomes a question now of like, well, we have all this other work to do. So what, you know, what can we get done and how do we do it? Or maybe we don't do a full, like the state, I know they were like, well, we're not going to be able to do this moose survey now. We'll do a recruitment survey. So at least we know how many calves from last year, you know, made it through, and we can put those into the population. So at least gives you a little bit of an idea. You're still going out looking at something. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so it's
what about in the years where there's too much snow? How does that affect the mobility of the animals?
Yeah, so if you're a moose, depending how much snow and where, if you end up being more down in like those river bottoms and stuff, sometimes you're stuck there, you know.
And that's very difficult for the young ones.
It can be, yeah. So that's one of the things that, you know, the Park Service hasn't done, but the state of Alaska has done, is they've done a spring short yearling. And short yearling, we define that as an animal who's, like, you know, about 9 months old. So not quite a year, but they're still a young. Mm-hmm. And so we throw that term out a lot, short yearlings. And so we've weighed those to be able to look at, you know, that kind of gives you also an indication of nutritional status as well. So, you know, if you weigh your males and your female short yearlings in the springtime, you know, is there a difference between these high snow years and low snow years? Ooh. One of the things that's been going on the last couple of years that the moose researcher has been doing has been weighing calves in the fall and then coming back and recapturing those same calves and weighing them in the spring to be able to look at the weight difference. And so that's all, he's in his second year of work. So in terms of, like, the results of that and what that means for the Seward Peninsula, comparing it to other areas around the state that have been doing it, I don't know what those are. Mm. So,
do you radio collar the animals or chip them?
Yep, they are radio collared.
Okay,
yep.
So that you can track them all and see where they're moving,
yep,
throughout the year.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
even if you can't get out on your surveys, you at least can tell where they are.
For the short yearlings, yeah, you know, for do that. Like, the state also has some muskox collared as well, and so you can track the movement. Maybe be able to tell a little bit on mortality. You know, if is it a high mortality year, and you know, or a low mortality year. So yeah, it all depends what your goal and your questions are.
Right.
So,
we've been hearing a lot about coastal erosion. Has that been affecting any of the wildlife populations at all?
I don't know if I can answer that.
Okay.
I mean, I just don't know enough of the coastal erosion.
Right. Yeah. No, that's okay.
So
I just kind of wondered. What other climate change or environmental changes are you seeing that affect wildlife population positively or negatively?
Well, I don't know. One of my questions has been with muskox is, you know, we've noticed, you know, the animals have, you know, kind of shifted their distribution where the areas where, you know, they're kind of moving a little bit further east and so forth in areas. And so my question is like, well, why, you know, is maybe vegetation quality better over here than, you know, where they were at, you know? I mean, no, to us, it looks all the same on the surface, but maybe there's something kind of like we were talking about with the moose. Maybe it's the quality over versus the quantity. So, so that's, you know, my question. That's one of my questions. It's not anything really, you know, environmental concern, but it kind of has me like, well, why are they moving into these new areas?
So how far are they moving then? And is it
yeah,
a slow and gradual, or is it just like they're there and then they don't come back?
Well, it's been kind of slow and gradual, but there were no muskox that we knew of in terms of, like, a viable population in the new Lotto Hills, so north of Unalakleet. But now you've got a good couple hundred animals, and you have animals now going that are over in the Yukon side, so more interior, and they just weren't there before.
Right.
So, and we were in Bering Land Bridge. We had actually quite a few muskox in the preserve and that subunit 22E, but now, you know, there's still some there, but not like what there used to be. So, and it's just been this shift. Yeah.
I guess I always heard that the approximate population on the Seward Peninsula for muskox was about 2,000.
Mm-hmm.
Was that?
It's just shy of 2,500.
Is it?
You
okay.
know, if you just look at, like, the midpoint.
And so some of that... those 2,500 are the ones that are now kind of hanging out down
Kills. Yeah. So we've always talked about this core area when we talk about the surveys, the core area being where these muskox used to be. So the preserve, you know, 22E, Nome, and then we have this, like, other all area. And these are all the new areas that have been added on because muskox have, you know, moved over into there. So, you know, and it's, and the question is, well, why? So
do predators come into that question as to why? Or?
You know, predators is a big topic that comes up, you know, to the public, to us, to meetings at like at the State of Alaska advisory committees, and then or even like the federal regional advisory councils. So that all comes up about, you know, are predators getting, you know, is it causing, are predators the reason why some of these animals are, have moved into Nome? Are predators the reason why they've kind of moved out of maybe the preserve, you know? So, but it's hard to say. So those are all questions that everyone wants to know and find out.
Yeah. Would the largest predator, what would be the largest predator then of muskox?
Oh, I would think that if a bunch of us were in a room together, we'd probably say bears.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so do you do bears then too?
When I was with the state, one of my jobs was sealing bears that were killed by hunters, mm-hmm. or dealing with bears that were taken as defense of life and property. So basically being like a major nuisance or dealing with nuisance bears that came into town. So that was one of, you know, roles. My role here is going to be very different with bears mm-hmm. than it was with the state.
So I'm just wondering, has there been an increase in bear population too?
Oh, well. That's, well, the state had collared bears in 89 and 90, and then they did the really big survey in 91, and they were able, so we're talking about a long time ago when this happened, and they were able to, you know, come up with an idea of, you know, here's, you know, a population is, but then, you know, counting predators versus counting like caribou and moose and stuff is very different because predators are so elusive and they're very expensive, very, very expensive to count because of that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they require more radio collaring and stuff. So what the Park Service did is come up with, and I think it was actually through the network, came up with a bear survey method to that would be similar to radio collaring but wouldn't require that amount. Mm-hmm. Of money or effort. And so that was done. We finally got it done in 2006 or 2007. There have been like 25, 30 year gap between this first survey. Mm-hmm. And plus you're talking about two different methods. And the survey in 91 was a smaller area compared to the survey in 2007. Or I think the survey was done a lot later than that. I think I have my year wrong on that. Mm-hmm. I'd have to double check. And so, but, so you don't know really what happened in that bear population. Did it go like this? Was it always like this? So another one's planned for 2020, I believe. And so, but yet you can go based off of what are people telling you? What are your harvest mm-hmm. ceiling records telling you? Harvest records are like, well, the Seward Peninsula takes about 100 bears a year. So if you're doing 100 bears a year, you know, approximately since 1997, I mean, you have to have recruitment back into that population. So then you hear from the public where they're like, well, I've seen sows with 3 or 4 cubs, you know, or then, but then I also hear from other side people saying, I don't see bears where I used to anymore. Mm. But the general consensus is there's more bears, but you know that's the what we hear from just anecdotal, right. You know, folks.
Yeah, that could mean a couple of things. That could mean that the bears are also moving, like the muskox, so you don't see them where you used to see them. Or and if a bear has 4 sows, so she's pretty healthy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and in order for all those cubs to live and for her to produce and everything else, I mean, she had to she had to be healthy to be bred. She had to be healthy to, you know, have those, and then to be able to support four of those little ones. So, and they stay with her for, you know, at least 3 years. So,
3 years.
You know, two years for sure, sometimes three. So, so, I mean, you hear, but a lot of the times you'll hear like there's just too many bears.
Yeah.
But then, yeah.
Hmm. Are there wolves too?
There are wolves. In terms of population, we just don't have a really good handle on that. Though I think we can all, like I said, when I say we all, I'm talking about a bunch of biologists that have sat around and just talked about this, or just with the public, that there's more wolves now on the Seward Peninsula. This is, once again, all anecdotal, and then compared to what people remember in living history, too. One of the things that like Nikki and I have talked about, though, is you had the reindeer herding out here, where it was, I mean, you had the largest reindeer herd was on the Seward Peninsula, and you had folks that were very active. I mean, they moved with those animals, they went everywhere, they were on the landscape. So, I mean, that was their livelihood, and so they couldn't afford to have like bears or wolves take down their deer. And so there's always that possibility that maybe, you know, numbers were kind of kept down during that time as well. For now, you have reindeer herding now, but not to the extent you did before. And there's just times change, rules have changed, regulations have changed, you know, how people herd have changed. And so, you know, it's given timing for animals to, you know, grow, repopulate and stuff. So those are all just, you know, hypotheses that like Nikki and I have, you know, talked about. Because, you know, you're like, well, why not? I mean, there was a lot going on with the Seward Peninsula that could keep numbers low.
Interesting.
Right. Now that those controls aren't there, nature takes over.
Nature takes over, animals move in, so forth, you know, and you know, for sure, as, you know, for wolves, you know, they probably, you know, come follow over the Western Arctic caribou herd, but you for sure also have resident wolves, too. In order to have resident wolves, they need to have local prey, too.
Yeah.
There's moose and muskox, and there are reindeer.
We were talking to Jeanette the other day, and she was talking about the increase in the beaver population. Can you speak to that at all?
Well, that, not really, other than, you know, if we're talking about like serpentine, for example, just, I mean, folks like Katie and Jeanette have probably way better view over the years, but just from looking at photos and hearing people and then seeing what's going on now, it's definitely appears like the beavers have, you know, for sure altered the vegetation around that area. I mean, they're not necessarily a bad thing either. Mm-hmm. They can be a really good thing for wildlife, you know, and like for swans, for example, in other parts of the United States, they've been fantastic in terms of like as protection. And but for like historical factors such as the hot springs and a cultural factor, you're like, oh, how, you know, what is this doing in terms of, you know, the beaver dams and lodges changing the course of the mainstream, and how does that affect? So it's I wouldn't know to say, oh, well, the beaver population's increasing or not. I just wouldn't know. As far as I know, there hasn't been any colony surveys done out here, though that would be really fun to do. Just fly around and, you know, be able to count the number of beaver lodges. And
that would be really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but, you know, I never really, until I came over to the Park Service and I started hearing about the concerns and the issues, it wasn't something I really had to think about in my other position. And so, but now I'm like, huh, yeah. And it just seems like maybe now that my mind's more on the radar, it just seems like that's what I hear so much now in the news, is like beavers and their establishment, and like they just don't need like those things can travel even without like water, you know, and just other parts of the world where they've talked about these beaver populations have just extremely grown. And so I think it just seems like these little guys are
very industrious.
Yes, yes. So yeah, I don't know that we did get funding to put on a beaver trapping class. Mm-hmm. and you know, it's a preserve, so you can hunt, you can trap in there, but a lot of the trapping, you know, it's expensive to do nowadays because of the price of gas and stuff. And if it's beavers are in some ways relatively new, they weren't really up into the preserve area, so that's another thing, as over time, maybe with shrubs and everything else and just establishment and some beaver just deciding she's gonna take a, you know, a little walk about. So, you know, just once again through talking with people and them saying in living history from the time they were little to now when, you know, they're like in their 50s or even older, they're like, well, we didn't have beavers in this area, but now we see beavers, you know. We see beavers up there at Serpentine, we see beavers over here. So in terms of like how to go about utilizing the beavers is fairly new. So we got funding to put on a beaver trapping clinic and also to be like, you know, how to use conibears or snares. And it was also a way of kind of mitigating maybe with Serpentine as well. You know, people could just go in there. But also is going to teach, like, you can also eat beaver. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a fairly new thing out here, but down the YK, you know, beaver's like a delicacy. So, but out here, be like, well, you know, you could eat beaver. Mm-hmm. So, in addition to skin sewing and stuff, which Shishmaref uses a lot of beaver to, you know, sew with, but a lot of those pelts are brought in from elsewhere. They're not necessarily, you know, been trapped or harvested out here on the peninsula.
Interesting. You mentioned about the beaver dams and, you know, more water, so swans are attracted. So is there a change in the bird population or the bird migration, even timing?
Oh, I can't speak to that. No, okay. I think it's been more Fish and Wildlife Service that has done the swan surveys and questionnaires and, like, the emperor geese surveys that are now being done, that's all through Fish and Game and maybe in cooperation with Fish and Wildlife Service. So,
right.
Tell you, I've been like big ungulates, predators.
Go ahead, Katie.
Are beavers trapped? I know they can be trapped in the winter time. Is there like a certain, like the best? The most ideal time of year to do that? And I guess I don't know the season too, like, is there an established season for that?
Yeah, so without getting into the whole nitty-gritty and boring, because I really do like the regulation portions of it too. Mm-hmm. So there is a prime time to get beaver, like when their pelts, just like, you know, it'd be like, mm-hmm. Just like any fur harvest, you know, that they will do, kind of like with wolves and stuff, you want to try to get them in their prime time, you know. One, that's when it's most useful, and also if you're trying to make some money, that's, you're going to make more money off of a pelt that's in prime coat condition. Mm-hmm. And so there are times, but it depends the area that you're living in. So for when it comes to regulation, so out here, it can be a little confusing because you have state of Alaska hunting and trapping regulations. And then you, because we're also in a subsistence area where we have many federally qualified users, then you have the federal hunting trapping regulations too. They don't always mirror each other in terms of season dates or bag limits. So for example, it says, you know, you may take an unlimited number of beavers. That may be what one side says. The other regulation side could say you may trap two beavers, you know. Mm-hmm. It all depends where you live. And out here it's a little bit more liberal. So, I mean, you still have trout, you still have season dates, you know, and mm-hmm. bag limits, and all depends, like, you know, how you're harvesting.
So what are the season dates for beavers? Do you remember offhand? Or?
I would need to look at a book.
Yeah.
So I don't say the wrong thing. Yeah. I would need to look.
Yeah. I'm just thinking spring time, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, I'd have to look in the book off the top of my head. It's always good. Anytime anyone is asking me about season dates, I always have to have the book because I don't want to give the wrong date because you can get in trouble.
The one book and then the other book.
It's true. Yes, I have like this book, the stack of books of hunting and trapping regulations.
Mm-hmm. Very, very layered. I didn't realize that there were so many different layers to that.
It can be very confusing it's something I've just dealt with for a long time. And even now, sometimes someone will ask me a question and I'm like, oh, that's a really good question, because it deals on more like, well, on a federal regulation or so forth. So, I mean, and that's so how do you simplify that to someone out in the field who's, you know, out in Shishmaref or Wales or someone and who doesn't necessarily know how to understand how to go about reading those books, or doesn't even have a regulation book. So,
So is that part of your job, is to try and educate people about that, or is that someone else's responsibility?
No, it's we actually all have like a responsibility to, you know, in terms of like, you know, it's everyone's wildlife. So yeah, my job with the state was very much informing the public, you know, and educating of like new season dates or changes or so forth, and even now, you know, in terms of like, you know, caribou regulations or season dates for moose or whatnot or muskox. That's all part of the job.
So we've heard in a few interviews that people are talking about changing or elongating dates for moose or caribou because of access is changing. For example, Jeanette was talking about there's not enough snow for people to go snowmobiling at the time when it's open season for moose or caribou. Can you talk to that at all?
Yeah, so like all those environmental changes we were talking about for survey work, well, then that also just has an impact on users as well. So a lot of times, I'll take the years, for example, that have had very low, you know, no snow years, very, very minimal. And a lot of times, you know, I'll be like, well, you know, we couldn't go up in the hills to go get caribou, you know, so it comes up all the time, high water, you know, or lack of water. Mm-hmm. A lot of times during this season, if we didn't have a lot of rain, then a lot of those areas where folks will go back and try to go hunt moose, they couldn't get up in there with their boats because there's just wasn't enough water. Or just really bad storms. So a lot of times environmental factors will bring people together and just be like, ask for season extensions or if they can, you know, have a longer season. And I've seen that many times on the state side of things. How it works on the federal, I don't know. I haven't been around long enough on the federal end for it, but it's normally on the state side where they ask for season extension.
And they're usually granted those season extensions? Or
many times they are.
Why would they not be?
It comes down to administration.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is it the Board of Fish and the Board of Game that determine that would be the yay or nay on those decisions? I guess I'm always a little confused at all of the different
So for the state of Alaska, you have the Alaska Board of Game, Alaska Board of Fish, and then on the federal side you have the Federal Subsistence Board that meets. And of course you have, that's where your advisory committees come from, and that's where your regional advisory council, I mean, they help guide, you know, these processes. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the biologists, you know, working in with the door shut, doing their own thing. It's, you know, it's supposed to be a very transparent public process. So yes, at one point, and this is where the whole comes down to administration, it would be if, say Wales wanted to extend a season date on moose, for example, and then they would submit a letter to the state of Alaska, and then it used to go like the Board of Game would have this emergency meetup, whether it was by teleconference or whatever, to discuss this, and they would make that determining factor. But that can change too, just depending on administration levels, because it's really has like commissioner authority. Mm-hmm. So of course now we're going into way away from environmental stuff, you know, but it shows a little bit how like policy and regulation can then very much get tied into environmental when it comes to subsistence users.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so if subsistence users aren't able to get out and get moose, and then the policy doesn't allow that either, that's like a double hit for subsistence.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, another thing too, in terms of like access, is just when we look at technology. Mm. So to go from Nome up into the preserve or in proximity of the preserve, it used to be very few people would do that because just it would, you know, the amount of fuel, just the terrain to get up there. I mean, it's pretty harsh country, you know. One day it can be all nice and sunny, and then like 2 hours later, you're just, you know, fogged in. And so there's big safety concern, but over time now you have like these other off-road vehicles that you see all over, six-wheelers and everything that just you... that has the capacity to take you further and further and further. So now you just, you know, you hear it's like if the moose population isn't doing well here, well then if you have the ability to go further, so that so people are, you know, going out and seeking that. Mm. So definitely, you know, environmental, you know, and also just ease of access of how, like, what do you have in your toolbox to get you further where there's moose.
I wonder in future if the use of drones will be employed.
Well, that, I mean, I would say it is now. By state of Alaska, they actually have a regulation because people have, I mean, why not, right? If you can't, why not use something that can help you
tell you where they are and that's where you go.
And so of like, use, so there are regulations in place of like what you can and cannot do with drones. So in the hunting form of it. So, and I know on the Park Service side, drones comes up a lot about whether to use it for survey work, the permitting process, you know, how it's being used. I do know some subsistence users in Shishmaroff that do have drones. And so that they say they use for marine mammals, which is a whole nother thing of regulations. And so, and or to look at conditions. So it's definitely being utilized.
Yeah. It's another technology.
Yeah. And what is it within, like, there's a pretty strict permitting process, right? Within, I believe, National Park Service managed areas for being able to use drones, from what I understand.
I think so. I've not had to go through it. I mean, I know you if you go through the step process enough, you can get that permit. I know of fish and game folks who have, and the fishery side of things, have done that. But
it's an amazing technology.
Yeah.
Like, just for thinking of, versatility of...
I mean, I've seen them buzzing over my house at times where I'm like, I feel, you know, this little, like, sounds like this very oversized mosquito just buzzing over, you know. And I've heard people have talked about them during hunting season. Now, whether or not they're using them for hunting is something completely different, but you do hear about, you know, people hearing and seeing drones while they're out there. So
there was a class or a club at the high school for a little while about learning how to use drones and different you know, for everything from like filming the coast along Nome or just all sorts of different uses, but really beautiful footage.
I think, you know, you can, right? And so for the most part, this part of the peninsula, we don't have trees, you know. So, you know, but yet you can have, like, and that was another thing, I guess, going back in some areas where it's just getting more shrubby, or you have, like, these little hills, and the illusion can be everything. Like, you're like, oh, well, that's actually a lot, you know, more shrub or higher ground than I was thinking, you know. So it's, yeah, why not just see something from the air?
And fairly, like, it seems fairly non-invasive to wildlife from I mean, as compared to perhaps other, perhaps other like noises that could impact.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know enough about that. I know in other parts of the United States and world, they've used drones to do some wildlife work or to move nuisance animals. Mm-hmm. So I don't, so yeah, I haven't really looked into like the impacts of like how that would affect. I know I had talked with a potential film crew that was coming up here from New Zealand, and she had asked about use of drones to get, you know, close to the animals. And I was like, well, you know, it could be considered harassment because we don't know, you know, because it is still, there's still a human somewhere that has to control this. Right. And so, yeah, but so it's still kind of like a cautious thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Interesting.
Getting back to the muskox, have you, since you've been working with them for a number of years, have you seen, other than the movement of them, changes over time, perhaps in their weight or their general health?
So those are all good questions. So there's so much we don't know about the muskox compared to what we know about caribou and moose.
Okay.
So the state just recently hired a muskox biologist researcher. So that's hopefully like that's what her whole focus is muskox, where, you know, like my job and stuff was very, had to be very broad.
Right.
She can just like, muskox is what I do 24/7. But the questions is like, we haven't really weighed muskox until she just started doing that this fall. So it's
so a few years before we
see
it.
It could
any
be
data.
A few years before any data to be able to like say anything, you know. But, you know, certainly, you know, muskox have a very different, you know, metabolism and everything, and also how they, you know, how they put the weight on, where they take the weight off, like after they give birth, and how. So there's a lot of questions there in terms of seasonal weight changes. As with every animal, but it's hard to sometimes answer those questions in a non-captivity, you know, sense.
Hmm.
Yeah. So,
just wonder over the years, is this, you know, the stature of the beast diminishing? Is it staying stable? Is it increasing?
Yeah, one, you know, there's very little animals being harvested on the muskox population out here. And I mean, there's like a total like 35 permits that are given, so that's like 2%, but less than that are being harvested, and those are state and federal, bulk of them being state permits.
And is that to keep the population stable?
It provides hunting opportunity because it's a subsistence resource, and so still a pretty rigorous process to get one of those permits because of the population. So even with very little population, calf recruitment's not going very well, you know, so then you the questions are why, you know.
So calf recruitment, you mean they're not having as many calves as you would think?
Well,
is that what you mean?
There doesn't appear to be very many calves being put into the population, so
the birth rate's low.
So, well, we don't know if birth rate's low, we just know that there's not.
Yeah. So they could be being born, but they don't survive.
Right, okay. You know, so those are just questions we just don't know, you know. We've had some muskox where we've found them where people call them saying, hey, there's, you know, a dead muskox here and here, so we go check it out. And she was actually, the cow was in the process of giving birth to a calf and died. Mm-hmm. And so we've seen that a couple times now. Whether that is indicative to anything, you know, who knows, but, you know, it makes you wonder as a biologist, like, you know, how often are they getting pregnant? How often are they, you know, is this
how many
occurring?
Died in child,
you know,
when they're giving birth?
Yeah. So, you know, but when we've done capture work, we've taken, you know, blood samples to look for brucellosis, to look for other diseases, you know, and, this population is pretty darn healthy in terms of like disease, mm-hmm. you know. So there's other stuff going on, and luckily the other muskox person will help find that out.
Right. And what about the caribou population? And which caribou herd is it, by the way?
The Western Arctic caribou herd.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd have to review my notes on that, because that population had declined.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, it declined to a point that there was some very necessary management issues that had to come into play, which then even was supported by user groups, the Western Arctic Working Group, and was adopted in because of, it was low cow, low calf, recruitment.
Do they know what the factors were to cause that? Was that a normal cyclical, or was it beyond a normal cyclical?
You know, Alex would be a good one to talk to about that. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So, but they've also changed technology too. It's also more, it's digital.
That's right.
Yeah, it's really, it's really nice digital camera, and then how you can, count now into ArcGIS, versus the whole black and white so you can actually see, differentiate between calves too, like this is a calf versus an adult. And so, speaking of terms of weather, they were supposed to do a caribou census this past July, and it didn't happen. I mean, they geared up, they went out there, and weather wasn't working out, and by the time weather did work out, the animals had already headed up into the hills and you couldn't do it. So there's environmental factor that prevented.
So you're finding the storms are increasing every year, or intensity is increasing, numbers going up? I mean, it might be hard to tell in such a short period of time.
I think for the last 2 years when we've had these storms come through, whether it's due to lack of, sea ice out there too, providing no, barrier. I think it's kind of too short for me to speak anyways, to say, that they're becoming more common or so forth. But I think the consensus across with a bunch of, folks in the career field I'm in is that how we have always done, counted animals or a certain method, for example, we need to maybe look at finding other ways to still get the same information but different method because of, the storms or because of lack of snow.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm sorry I cut you off about the caribou. How is the population, herd numbers, and health now for the Western caribou?
So they've had a small increase,
mm-hmm.
But because they weren't able to get the census done because of these environmental factors. So they're going to try again in July of this year. They're going to try to get another census done.
Yeah.
Because it is really important, because that herd experienced, such a decline that, and then it's like the small, so they definitely need to go back and, and that's also part of the reason why they do the collaring.
Mm-hmm.
It's mainly in the state, but the Park Service helps out as well, puts collars out on the caribou, and that usually occurs there on the Kobuk River. And for whatever reason this year, they decided to really not cross the river. And we've noticed this the last couple of years where you've been normally been able to get all your collars out. They have been for 20 some years. It's not been a problem. You might have to wait for 2 weeks, but you get it done. And they just have not been coming through. And so
they're not crossing the river. Is the river's far too deep, I wonder?
They're pretty good swimmers. I don't know, but even from what hunters, a lot of folks will go up there because everyone talks about Onion Portage, that this is where you go get caribou, and a lot of people were either had to travel further or they just didn't get caribou this fall because they weren't coming across the river.
Mm.
And most of the time, as it generally works out, is the herd will winter on the Seward Peninsula. And so folks out here will have an opportunity to go travel, Shishmaref, and all that they have will have access to caribou. it's not that there's not any caribou out here right now. It's just the bulk of the herd stayed up north and in Gates of the Arctic, which is, from what I've been told, a first. So,
and I think there's caribou have been, from what I understood, you know, passing through that Onion Portage area for like 9,000 years. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, yeah, so that's a huge, I wonder what will happen this year. It's just a huge change.
I just wonder why they're not coming down. Is there enough food source up there? Yeah. I mean, migratory animals usually have this need to move.
You know, the retired fishing game caribou biologist would be like, oh, and for another, you know, 18th year, the caribou did something different. Mm-hmm. But what they did this year was really, you know, like...
Unique,
but that they stayed up there. Hmm. So
interesting.
Yeah. And so, was it environmental? Was it, did they know? I mean, we don't know.
Right.
So, I mean, we can totally speculate and throw, you know, ideas out, but...
Until there's a few years where there's a trend, it could be a one-off.
Yeah. You mean, you'll just have to see. You're like, well, you know, okay, you recognize this. You file it in the back of your head and take note of it, and then... You just, yeah, see, now does this become, like, is this going to become a thing?
Right, right, yeah. So, and then, so, sorry, Katie, did you have a question?
Oh, no, I was just, yeah, nope.
Okay. So, moose population, same type of question. You said that earlier that there was more moose, or that people anecdotally were saying that there were more moose. Am I correct on that? Mm. Is that earlier that you were saying that? Or
No, it's actually less. Yeah,
sorry.
Less moose. And we were probably talking about bears.
Right, sorry, we were. Yeah.
Yeah, so no, you know, there used to not be moose out here on the Seward Peninsula. Yeah. You know, so in terms of, like, you know, that's in people's loving mind, you know, that's a fairly, you know, recent thing. But also, I mean, back in, like, the 80s, you know, there was, like, a good-sized moose population out here. You know, you had, like, this general season. There was, you know, there was moose for everyone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the case, has not been the case. And, you know, they feel back in the records is that, you know, there were some pretty harsh winters during that time period, too. So the thought is that they just got to... you know, their peak of the population. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to this, you know, harsh climate and weather that occurred during that exact same time, the population crashed, you know. And of course, you know, there's always the question of, you know, bears and, like, what are the bears doing to moose calves? So, you know, you hear today, you know, you go to meetings or, and they'll just be like, well, the moose population isn't like it was when, you know, you're like, well, maybe it could have never been that high. Maybe it can never get to be that high. But you can't change what people, you know, because more moose, right? More, you know, more moose is better. And so there's not, it's hunting restrictions. It's all out here. It's state registration permit. There's a quota. You have to call in by so many days. You know, sometimes the hunts close in 1 to 2 days, you know. So it's...
So you collar them too?
Some of the moose are collared.
And so when you capture them and you're doing blood samples and weighing too, have you seen an increase or decrease in weight and health of the moose population?
So back when, and it was when Tony Gorn was weighing those, you know, he was weighing them in the spring, those short yearlings. And it's definitely work that has been done in the interior by researchers. And so, you know, they came up with this ideal weight of, like, you know, this magic number of 375 pounds. And so if your moose calves were, you know, right there or below, then, you know, they were nutritionally stressed, you know. And so,
interesting.
You know, but... And then there's the difference of, like, when you're weighing them in the fall and then how much weight they could potentially lose between fall and then, you know, at this time of year, you know. And so, and he only has a couple of years of data, so I know, but I just know in the fall there, we had some young bulls. So they're like 6-7 month old calves that were like 550 pounds.
Woo-hoo!
That was a, yeah. And that was a lot, you know? And then, so I just haven't talked with him to see what, you know, in his couple years of working with the data, what it has shown compared to back when Tony had, had dealt with it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting.
So, but yeah, so it all plays back into, you know, like this environment of, you know, how much snow, how much food, the quality of it. So
predators again.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we were talking before we turned on the recorder. You're getting ready. Hopefully, is it next week that you're hoping to get out? So can you tell us a little about what you're hoping to achieve?
Yeah, so they're called muskox composition surveys. So, and to simplify that, it means we're going to go to groups of animals and we break them into categories. Like, so first we look at males, but then we break those males down into age classes. You know, is it a 2-year-old, is it a 3-year-old, or is it a mature bull, which is, in our sense, 4 years and older?
Mm-hmm.
We do the exact same thing with cows, too. Is it a 2-year-old cow, a 3-year-old cow, or a mature cow? We'll also see if there's any short yearlings in there. Now, by the time we start this, there could be some new calves on the ground, too, so we'll also... So the reason for this, you know, is one... The characteristics and the growth of their horns, you can tell how old they are.
Okay.
And you can pretty much, and also by the thickness too, you can identify a 2-year-old cow versus a 2-year-old bull too pretty easily. And in terms of the thickness of the horns, it still takes a little bit to train your eye for it. And so it's important for that. So we can look at one recruitment of how many animals survived from when they were a calf the previous fall through the harsh winter into spring. And also for the bull cow proportions, like out of this entire population, what percentage of them are mature bulls? So that's important in terms of like for hunting, for the number of permits that the state issues and that the feds, National Park Service and BLM will issue.
So if there's not as many bulls, of course, people aren't allowed to take a lot of bulls.
It's, you know, we have to then look at it, be like, okay, in which areas maybe have a little bit less hunting opportunity, maybe a little bit more hunting opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Also gives an idea that we can take this information that we're getting and compare it to previous years. So the last time was in 2017. So we could compare it to that and be like, okay, you know. Me. So, yeah, so even though we didn't get the population estimate, we can still get from the composition surveys a good idea what's going on with the bulls.
Do you also look at genetic diversity then?
That's a good question because genetics has come a really long ways. So there have been folks who have looked for their graduate studies at genetics and so forth, you know, and thing with muskox, very slow genetics, you know,
okay.
So it's almost like a bottleneck in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
But then the really interesting thing about the muskox in Alaska is, you know, they were reintroduced out here. And so the original ones came from Greenland.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were brought to UAF. And from UAF, you know, after a few years, some of them were put out on Nunavak Island. So all these animals that are out here on the Sierra Peninsula, North Slope, Nunavak, Nelson, all come from the small group of animals that were brought over from Greenland. So,
yeah.
So it would be the talk of, like, you know, genetics, you know, could that be playing, you know, a cause in, you know, what's going on in some cases, then, I mean, it would definitely be worth something to look at again, just because someone did the work of genetics 20, 30 years ago. So much has increased in technology, you know, and how you look at genetics.
So do you do any comparison studies in muskox between the ones in Alaska and the ones in the Northwest Territories in Canada?
A lot of times, so there has been some collaboration in terms of, like, you know, what do you do with mm-hmm. your muskox, or how do, you know, a lot of times is like, how do you manage your hunts? And over there, a lot of times they'll have, like, you know, they also have like a commercial harvest mm-hmm. where we don't have that in the state of Alaska. You know, you don't sell, we can't sell game meat. But you know, they have, or like, how often do you do a population? Mm-hmm. And a lot of times mm-hmm. it's like a really long time in between when some of those Canadian muskox populations are surveyed, you know? Yeah. And so we're always kind of taken back because they have thousands and thousands of muskox in some of those areas, yeah. you know, over in the Nunavut area. So, but, you know, in comparison, one of the things that we look at too is like out in the YK with Nunavak Island is a same, you know, area, but it's in an island where it's predator free. I mean, you have your, you know, Arctic fox, red fox, and then you have humans. So those are, you know, your predators for the muskox there. But the biologists out there with the state, their population's doing really well, you know, and they have a lot of permits that they give out. I mean, his yearlings getting pregnant, you know, and all this. And then out here, it's, you know, there's a lot more just going on. It's, you know, we have predators, but we're not seeing this viable recruitment like, you know, Nunavak is. So that is one of the questions mm-hmm. as to that the muskox researcher with the state's looking at is why? What's the difference between, you know, is it vegetation? Mm-hmm. What's going on between Nunavak, muskox, and, you know, and these ones?
So when you go out next week to do your study, is it all just, do you land and how do you do it? Explain
what one of these is. So normally our population census, when we are flying these transect lines, you know, if we find groups of muskox, those are normally then what we would look at for this composition survey. But because of weather and priorities and stuff, the survey didn't happen, so we had to go look for groups, you know, on our, we had to do some recon flights. So it's going to involve using an R-44 helicopter and getting, because we can land easily, you know, without having to like worry about being on skis, and also just taking off as well. And sometimes muskox can be on fairly, you know, low elevation, flat ground along the coast. Other times they can be like very at the top of the hill, so you need to be able to access them. So we'll be based out of Kotzebue, and we'll go visit a group in Bering Land Bridge, and that group, when we found it in end of March, was 60 plus animals. So that could take a couple hours to classify, because you want the animals calm, and not being all like all grouped mm-hmm. up, because then the little ones will hide in there, and 60 animals is a lot to classify, you know.
Yeah.
and you want them to, you wish that they could just be like statues and not move, you know, just look at me straight on and not move, but that's not the case.
So as soon as you land, they don't form that circle and terrify.
We've used Bering Air out here. A lot of times we've also used other helicopter pilots out of Fairbanks, but they all have a lot of experience mm-hmm. working around the wildlife and know that, you know, because in a sense we are harassing them when we're coming up, but we don't want them to move or start running. And so they're really good about that. And also means like me communicating with the, you know, helicopter pilot about like, okay, you know, this is good. We can just walk from here. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes, you know, if they're up on a hill and you've got these little other ridges, you can kind of, you know, sneak up on them and walk up. But definitely you want them in a fairly calm state, because once they decide that there's something's not right, mm-hmm. it can be really hard to do the job. Yeah. You don't think those animals can run very far or fast, but they do. And if you're just on foot, you know, and so, but we have spotting, we have a really nice spotting scope that we use, so we can be a little bit further away too. Oh. So that way we're not having to be right up in, you know, the animal space. We also have binoculars, and so it's, you know, a really good way to just also, you know, be on the ground, because while you're, it's just a lot of times just quiet. Weather-wise, it can be super gusty. You know, it's like 30-mile-an-hour winds trying to look through a spotting scope. And you're like, and your eyes are, you know, they're tearing up and forming, you know, icicles. And but you're like, but I'm in a R-44 and I get to be on the ground looking at muskox, so I'm okay with, you know, 30-mile-an-hour gusting winds. So, so, you know, and there's always two of us that, you know, one for safety and just to always confer and stuff. So, I'm actually going to be taking out, fishing game person with me. It was all kind of happened very quickly. And so, and she has not, classified muskox before. So it'll be a bit of a learning experience for her in this, because a lot of the work is actually going to be done outside of the preserve. There's only one group in the preserve we're doing, and then the rest of them are all east and east of Buckland, kind of heading more towards the interior of the state. So,
and then you'll share this data with this new person who's come on, that's the new muskox person?
Well, then what I do is I'll go back and I'll work with Fish and Game here in Nome with the data, and then, you know, we'll come up with what the bull cow ratio is, what the calf recruitment is, you know, or proportion of mature bulls to cows. And so, that's,
but on this trip, it's not like you're weighing them or doing blood samples or anything.
No. I wish I was doing that. But no, I won't be doing. We don't have any plans right now from the Park Service end to collar any muskox at the moment.
Yeah. Exciting.
Yeah. So doesn't mean there can't be in the future, but you just have to have a really good reason.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. What do you see future challenges in your work?
Future challenges in the work is definitely going to be getting the survey work done, in addition to like what weather is doing, you know, whether that's having multiple storms or whether that's having no snow. It seems to be not be to be a happy medium at the moment. It's one or the other. And so that seems to be the, I think that's going to be the biggest challenge for me and for other biologists who, you know I've talked with some vital sign people, Pam, who deals with the weather. And so her job takes her everywhere across the state too, like out here in the preserve and also in Denali. And it was March, mid to late March, I want to say, when I last spoke with her, that she normally goes to Denali to get peak snow levels and stuff, and like the snow was gone, like you know, and pilots were, you know, they hadn't put their plane, I mean their planes were on bush wheels, they weren't on skis. And so in terms of like what she needed to do for her work was already very much a challenge for her.
Wow.
So it's, yes, so it's not even like the biologist side, it's even other folks who are looking at, you know, climate and their roles in the environment.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
One thing we've been asking people is, so being here, people more understand the changes that are happening, but how do we tell other people in the lower 48 in the world, and why should it be important to them?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, it's, and I can't imagine that they're not experiencing some of their own environmental, you know, chaos as well, you know, in terms of snow and, or maybe what appears to be more fire. So, I mean, I think it's a question they have to ask themselves too, you know, but it's, I think it deals with like a lot of outreach, and this is like where Katie comes in, you know, because it is, or just being able to just talk to someone, you know, in a layman's terms about, you know, well, here's what, you know, we've been seeing, and here's what it could mean, or here's what, you know, here's what it means to a hunting. But you also have to be open-minded to be able to hear, you know, to hear this, that, you know, this is a concern, not being able to know the number of moose on a landscape, you know, not only for a population, but also for a consumptive purpose, yes. You know, so, I think it just depends how open-minded someone wants to be to hear.
Right.
Because you can put all the outreach out there, and you can tell people, and...
yeah. Well, I know that was one thing Katie was interested in, is like, how do you get this across and make it important to other people? That was one thing we had talked about.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 The idea of, if we were chatting with a group of students, you know, in New Hampshire, where I'm from, what could we share with them about what's happening here? And then, because there's very, like you said, you know, there's a lot happening in, you know, all, like, in so many places, but there's different ways that people are experiencing it and different impacts that people are seeing and things like that. So, I think it's a really interesting question.
I think, you know, or maybe, like, out here, and when you get to talk with Gay would be really good, and Roy and them is, like, the sea ice, right? Yeah. You know, you hear that the most, like, you know, there's a lot of images, you know, in terms of through NOAA and through just people's experience, that be talking about, like, you know, the sea ice and, you know, how just the extent of it or lack of it. And I think you can, in terms of people being able to visually understand and see that, mm-hmm. you can, you know, I think that is a really good one to, when we talk about our environmental changes out here. Like, you know, I saw a boat, and posted a photo yesterday on a Gnome post, and it was this young kid.
I saw that.
It was in a Lund boat, and, you know, and it's just like this water's raining. I mean, you wouldn't even have known it was April.
Yeah.
And he had gotten his first seal. And so they were really proud, you know, and they were willing to, you know, give it to someone. But I'm like, wow, you wouldn't even know that was April. I mean, to just be out, you know, cruising around in a Lund boat in this open water.
No hat, you know, like, or like,
I know, spring, like, summer, it was kind of. So, had you shown that photo to me, I would have been like, oh, that's summertime. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I would not have even thought, like, that's not April. it was. Yeah. So I think, you know, stuff like that is a really good way of, you know, being able to have people maybe from, like New Hampshire, Washington, or even Texas, you know, just broadly here, being like, there are some major changes going on here.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm. One thing I just thought of as you were saying that, and this may be a silly question, but any of these seasonal changes affecting the seasonal gestation period, not gestation periods, but breeding seasons or the cycles of animals?
No, it's definitely not a silly question at all. It comes up in, you know, topic all the time. And also just depends, like, you know, your latitude, you know. Well, I guess one of the things that comes on my mind is, like, twinning surveys for, mm-hmm. you know, for moose. Like, maybe when the interior does twinning surveys, might be a little bit later than what, you know, Warren tried here. Or a ptarmigan during the breeding season when they've done ptarmigan surveys, and it might start a little bit, you know, earlier in the interior versus out here. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, definitely, I think, you know, it definitely can cause changes, you know, having environmental changes can definitely cause it when animals can start breeding, even with, you know, migration too.
Yes.
So yeah, not a silly question at all, but it's just one of those, like, how much do we know to talk about it? And I mean, and I just haven't dived into that part of it.
Like, you just wonder with the birds, are they laying eggs a little earlier? Are they coming here earlier? Or, you know,
it definitely, for, like, you know, for these animals, for like ptarmigan who are going to be nesting really soon and stuff, you know, or even like swans who are going to be here soon, and is, you know, if you're having like a really wet spring sometimes, I mean, it can cause nest failure, you mm-hmm. know, and just depending on the species, they may or may not, you know, lay eggs again. And so that's, you know, right. you get that one time and they're just doing what they're programmed to do. And then you have, yeah. you know, and there was one spring where we had just really late spring and there was just a lot of water. And, it was the thought of, person who's very avid birder and that, you know, that maybe there was, some nest failure going on. Mm-hmm. So,
and with spring coming earlier, are the bears coming out earlier?
So we've definitely during moose surveys, and like I said, our moose surveys can start in mid-February. Mm-hmm. In other parts, like in Cotsview area, they can start later, but we definitely have seen bear tracks in early and mid-February. I mean, we've even a couple years ago, if I'm recalling, we were even having calls in like January about, you know, people seeing bear tracks, you know, and I mean, they go in and I mean, it's all based on like, you know, weather and stuff and temperature. So if
it's warm and in February, you wake up.
Right. And it just wasn't just reports of, you know, unless you're a peninsula, but, you know, reports that, you know, in Anchorage and other areas that ADN were reporting on that, you know, they were, you know, getting, you know, signs of black bears, you know, like mm-hmm. really early in the springtime, yeah. you know, it would still be considered winter by our standards. So, yeah, you know, you can definitely, they can be out early.
Mm. Yeah. You just wonder what that's going to do to the usual breeding cycles and what the effect that's going to have, but we won't know for several years.
You don't know, and someone would need to look at that, and you know, like, and that would be like collaring and really being able yeah. to follow, you know, that sow and being able to be like, okay, how many times is she reproducing? Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. So, which I'm sure someone's probably looking at
some graduate thesis study. Katie, did you have any other questions?
I had one question on, of all of the questions that you're answering, you know, that you're formulating about different populations and different species. Is there one question that interests you the most in, like, that is, like, your research passion for?
That interests me the most. For me, I want to say the muskox vegetation, you know. Mm-hmm. I've always been interested in the vegetation, but I also really like the reproduction and the endocrinology, too. So, mm-hmm. you know, two very separate things, vegetation and reproduction. But in terms of, like, my question earlier was, like, well, what's going on, you know, could there be something vegetation wise that are causing these animals to move, you know? So that's something for, you know, here that I want to dive in next to, you know, and start. So once I get my head above water with all this muskox stuff that I'm finishing up, then I want to start looking at this next one and hopefully have it be a funded project. Mm-hmm. So, but it's going to take, you know, a lot of people, you know, in terms of like the methodology, having the stats, you know, so yeah, it usually involves quite a few people because it would be like a new method really of mm-hmm. like, how do we go about looking at this, or maybe building off of Claudia's work, what she did up in Cape Krusenstern. So
you mentioned your interest in the vegetation for the muskox. Do you remember several years ago at UAF, some of the muskox died off and they found that it was due to the lack of a certain mineral in the food in the soil that was there?
Hmm. I vaguely remember.
And I don't remember which mineral it was, but because they're in a staid population and normally they'd be out traveling and moving on the land, they would get enough of this mineral, but then they discovered that on the farm they needed to supply this mineral. Hmm. I'm just wondering, maybe is it vegetation and also mineral composition? Are the animals moving because they do need other minerals from the soil that maybe they're not getting? Just an idea.
And no, it's absolutely true, because folks like Peter Nightluck and stuff, who really are looking at vegetation for just in terms of the environment, have said, we've noticed that the soils have been warming, so that means changes in composition,
Right.
changes in, so yeah, and if you're having changes in minerals, it can totally affect the changes in vegetation and what those, so
And totally affect birth rate, totally affect health of animals.
yeah,
Wow.
so it's
That's interesting.
so one of the things that has been collected is and Jim Lawler, when he's with Park Service, when he'd go out, he would collect feces from muskox. So we'd go out there, go look at them through the binoculars, and we'd go pick up some frozen ones and put them in a baggie. So, and I think a lot of people are like, wow, you get so much enjoyment picking up,
But you learn so much from
right.
binoculates.
So that's what we did
Yeah.
a few weeks ago when I was working up in Cape Krusenstern, and then we'll do that next week too. And so I want to talk with him about, okay, because he just has this whole pile of fried poo on his desk from years, right? Just on his desk. And so I'm like, what can we do with this? So,
What minerals are in there and what are lacking would be an interesting, yeah.
yeah.
Interesting. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us that we haven't talked about your work?
I don't think so. I guess it's always just a Well, I love to talk about the land animals, but Gay will get into the seals and marine, and so will Austin and them, but the fish too.
Yeah.
So, we can't forget about they are, in terms of like a subsistence, like of what gets utilized the most is fish, and so what is that doing in terms of like is that bringing in fish earlier, later, having these high waters or new, generally you get like chum and pinks who can handle colder water, but then as the water temperatures are warming, if they're warming in certain areas, is that going to cause other salmon species to come in? So those are all questions. And one of the things that we're hoping to do, if it gets funded, is to be able to answer some of those
So, do
questions.
you work with fish then too, with marine, or I thought you were just land animal?
Well, I saw this need that was coming from the Stewart Peninsula Regional Advisory Council of like, we need to know what's going on with our fish. So while I'm not a fish biologist, I can understand that there's this need and there's this work that hasn't been done in the park or in the preserve in a really long time. So a lot of times I'm like, okay, you really know this method, you're a fish person, so it is really a matter of me trying, who do I talk to? I'm also pretty lucky to be with someone who's a fisheries biologist too, so well, so he gets to hear about me talk about land animals, and then I get to hear him talk about fish. So as a result of that too, I have like a small little, connection group of fish folks that I can go to, and they can point me in other directions. So in working with Park Service fish biologists out of Anchorage and Fish and Game here and out of Anchorage, and that they'll, help me do this, work,
Excellent.
So in terms of looking at genetics, looking at the presence of salmon species, it also provides one, it's good, it's what folks from Wells and Shishmaref and Deering and Buckland have been asking, but it's also necessary for part of our park management plan
Right.
too.
Have you been seeing any other species of fish coming in then, with the water temperature changing, or is that known yet?
I don't know anything about that.
Through the Bering
Not
Strait, but
through the
yeah,
strait,
I'm
I
not
know, but
sure
I'm
about
wondering through the
like
rivers if you've
I don't
known.
know. Oh, no. That would be one to ask Nikki, because mm-hmm. her role when she was with Fish and Game was to do household subsistence surveys.
Okay.
Where, you know, they would ask, you know, these questions, and a lot of times, you know, just things come up as they get talking to folks.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I'll make a note of that.
So in terms of, you know, looking at, like, what's, you know, coming in, what's passing through, is there any, and that's part of the thing with looking at the genetics, hopefully with the CHUM, is, like, you know, comparing them to the other stuff out here in Norton Sound and even Kotzebue, and mm-hmm. being like, you know, which stocks are we, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. getting up in the preserve.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Okay.
So.
Interesting. Yeah. That'll be really interesting. And you'll start that project. Well, you're kind of already, like, it's already starting, right?
Mm, that, well, kind of. We won't know until the end of January if the proposal got funded. I mean, we're hoping. I mean, considering that was my first fish proposal I've ever put in for. And I'm so, and, but yeah, that's when you have like a really great team of people to, you know, and mm-hmm. I put it right out there. I laid all my cards out. I was like, I'm brand new at this and writing this. And.
But look at the expertise you have around you.
Right. And so I was like, and they jumped at the opportunity to, you know, do this work in the preserve, you right. know, so. Yeah, so I was like, great, you know, I'll write it up, you review it, and, you know, and so basically it comes down
and
to...
And who's the funder? Who are you looking to have it funded by?
It's through Office of Subsistence Management, right. Yeah. Good. So we'll see.
Well, good luck with that.
Yeah, so if it gets funded, it'll start next June, I guess.
Wow.
Or August. Which seems like a really long ways away, but I'm finding out as I'm diving more into this that with all the paperwork and permitting and stuff, it's really not that far away. So,
right. Yeah. Well, I hope you're, is it next week that you're hoping to head out?
Yeah, I'll head out Monday, and then if the weather's all good, we'll start doing the work on Tuesday.
Right. So. Well, the weather here has been absolutely beautiful for a number of days. I hope you get good weather where you're going.
Yeah, the winds need to be ideal and not have anything hazy, so yeah. It'll be hopefully... When I did the work a few weeks ago up in Cape Cruz and Stern, I could not have asked for a better survey weather, you know, like muskox were, I mean, I'm not in very good shape for hiking at the moment. So I was like, oh boy, if I'm going to have to hike up that hill, this is not going to be good. So, but it worked out that muskox were in like pretty ideal locations and, you know, but even then, like we got that warming spell of like 40 degrees, in late March, and I had just finished up doing a muskox population survey out there, and it was all white, all just completely white from the coast all the way inland. And then I went back out there like a week and a half, 2 weeks later, and so much of the hilltops and along the coast were brown, and just trying to find like a group of four bulls. And I'm like, and you just got lucky. You're like, oh, there they are. They're brown on brown. You just saw a flash of movement. And I couldn't, had I waited to do that population survey any longer, I wouldn't have been able to do it very well. I wouldn't have felt comfortable with the results or the fact that I'm spending money and not going to have good results.
Wow. Well, I wish you luck. Yeah, I hope it goes good. And thank you for your time. I know how busy you've been, and we really, really appreciate all your expertise.
Thank you
so much, Maddie.
Well... So is this a project, like, are you talking with, like, is it just talking with Park Service folks?
Yes.
Are you okay?
No, not just Park Service folks, also subsistence people and anyone who can talk to any environmental or climate changes that they've experienced in the area.
Yeah, if you can, like, if Jim Dow's around, I mean, he's in Kotzebue. I mean, he and his wife Randy travel quite a bit now and stuff. But, you know, in terms of how you were asking about, like, the caribou and the ice and stuff, you know, if he's, he would be a really good one to talk with.
Okay. I'm just turning this off right now. Thank you. So thanks, Letty. Okay.